National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, December 6th, 2023, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together every Wednesday morning here on KYMN Radio to discuss national security. We're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to explore national security challenges and opportunities. We're taking a bit of a break today from the in-depth, hard-hitting coverage of America's myriad national security challenges. However, I think you'll still enjoy the show we have lined up for you. Today, we're going to speak with three authors about their books, which I say fall into the national security thriller genre. Think Tom Clancy, but for modern challenges, or perhaps historical national security fiction woven into the fabric of real-world crises. We're going to learn how American national security challenges from yesterday and today influence and inspire the creation of thriller novels that capture our attention, keep us riveted for hours as we plow through these stories, and hold us on the edge of our seats until the very end of the book. We have three authors with us today, all of whom write in this genre. Let me introduce you to them. Our first is John Harrigan, who goes by the nom de guerre J.J. Harrigan. J.J. Harrigan writes historical thrillers. He acquired a taste for international intrigue from his experience as a former soldier during the Cold War, as a U.S. Foreign Service officer in Latin America, and as a professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Today, he writes his tales of intrigue from his home on the banks of the St. Croix River in Minnesota, where he lives happily with his wife, Sandy. His latest book, Goodbye Cuba, sets you in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, possibly the most dangerous week in the history of the world. He will also be releasing two other novels next year. Goodbye Bobby takes you back to presidential candidate Bobby Kennedy and his hopes to end the Vietnam War. And another book, Goodbye Virtue, recreates the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979 through 81 through the eyes of a hostage and his wife back home. All are published by Bronzewood Books. Our second guest is David Bruns. David Bruns earned a Bachelor of Science in Honors English from the United States Naval Academy. That's not a typo. He's probably the only English major you've ever met who took multiple semesters of calculus, physics, chemistry, electrical engineering, naval architecture, and weapon systems just so he could read some Shakespeare. He thinks it was totally worth it. For 6 years, David served as a U.S. Navy submarine officer where he played cat and mouse with the Russian Navy in the North Atlantic. When the Cold War ended, he was out of a job. He spent 20 years in the high-tech industry in sales, marketing, and general management. During that time, he moved 7 times, including to both U.S. coasts, Singapore, and finally to Minnesota. One day, he decided to just quit his job and start writing novels. According to David, yes, it really was that sudden. Now he writes science fiction under his own name and also co-writes contemporary national security thrillers. David Bruns is a graduate of the prestigious Clarion West Writers Workshop. He is the author of over 20 novels and dozens of short stories. Finally, our third guest is David McCloskey. David McCloskey is the author of the novels Moscow X and Damascus Station. He's a former CIA intelligence analyst and former consultant at McKinsey & Company. While at the CIA, he wrote regularly for the President's Daily Brief, delivered classified testimony to congressional oversight committees, and briefed senior White House officials, ambassadors, military officials, and Arab royalty. He worked in CIA field stations across the Middle East throughout the Arab Spring and conducted a rotation in the Counterterrorism Center focused on the jihad in Syria and Iraq. During his time at McKinsey, David McCloskey advised national security, aerospace, and transportation clients on a range of strategic and operational issues. David was born and raised in Arden Hills here in Minnesota. He graduated from Moundsview High School before heading off to conquer the world. He holds a Master of Arts from the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, where he specialized in energy policy and the Middle East. J.J. Harrigan, David McCloskey, and David Bruns, gentlemen, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, John.
Are we good now? All right, there we go. So, gentlemen, I want to dive right in with the three of you. I want to interview all three of you today, make sure we get plenty of time with each of you. I want to learn about your methodology and your inspiration for writing these books, but I want to start with this first question. Maybe we'll start with J.J., we'll start with you. Why did each of you decide to become authors? Writing a book is a pretty significant commitment of time and energy, especially if you have to research the historical facts and weave them into a story, or research modern challenges and bring the technical details to life for the reader. So, J.J., let's start with you. Why did you become an author?
Well, I guess two things happened. Well, I already was an author. I had 2 textbooks while I was teaching at Hamline. I've been teaching for many years. And after a while, you get kind of a hankering to do something different. And two things really triggered it. One was late in the spring, I got a call from my publisher who wanted me to come up with new editions of both my textbooks. Hmm. Now, normally this would be a great news for an author, but it depressed me because I knew I was going to have to spend the next two summers in the basement of Wilson Library, the University of Minnesota, poring over erudite research articles after article after article, looking for those little golden nuggets of wisdom that would make my next edition sparkle over the previous ones. And the idea of spending my time doing that again depressed me. The second thing that happened about the same time was we had a curriculum change at Hamline. Well, we were all pushed to develop an interdisciplinary course. I never understood why we did that, because it seemed to me our students were bright enough that they could make the connections between what they learned in my course with what they learned in David's course without us needing a special course to bring it all together. And it also seemed to be a waste of our expertise. I mean, we all had spent years developing an expertise in a subject, and now we were moving on to something else. But anyway, I was a faithful faculty member, so I developed a course on politics and fiction.
Okay.
And in that course, I'll never forget, one day, I had them reading, they were reading novels and looking at movies from mid-20th century on. And I'll never forget this one young woman, Ms. Benson, that was her name, Benson, I remember her name. I remember it clearly. She'd been reading this novel, which wasn't all that great, set in 1947, but she loved it. And she said to me, she said, "I wish I could have lived in those times." And that floored me, because nobody had ever said to me they wished they could have lived in the times that I wrote about in my textbooks.
Oh, yeah.
And I realized something, that with a novel, you can touch people in a way that you can't with scholarly research.
Yeah.
So that decided it. I decided then and there I was going to quit teaching. I was going to quit researching textbooks. And I was going to spend all my time writing historical fiction where I wouldn't have to do any research.
All right.
Now, what deluded me into thinking you could write historical fiction without doing any research? I don't know. But sometimes we need a few delusions to get us to take the next step in life. And so that's what got me into it, John.
Okay. And David McCloskey, so you were at CIA. I think a lot of people would kill to get a job at CIA. And then you switched over into the consulting world with McKinsey & Company. What drove you to become an author?
Yeah, I maybe a similar answer with plenty of delusion thrown in there. I think that'll probably be a common theme across these answers. So I had worked on Syria the entire time I was at CIA. I joined as an undergrad intern. I actually took my first polygraph when I was 19 and started when I was 20. And so I had worked on Syria, lived in Syria for a while. And over the course of that time, Syria descended into a awful civil war, which I think is almost impossible for us to imagine how much suffering there has been in that place. And when I left the CIA, I was actually fairly, I'm emotionally racked by this, I would say. And I had never studied writing. You know, I mean, I'd gone through English classes in high school. I don't even know if I'd taken them in college. I'd never taken a creative writing course. But for whatever reason, I started to just write a set of reflections. Some were sort of fictional stories, some were not, about my time living in Syria, working on Syria while I was at the CIA. And I wrote about 100,000 words of stuff, which I think at the time I thought was okay, but you know, upon further reflection and review, it was awful. And it was more like a set of journal entries than anything, right? There was no, turns out if you want to write a thriller or a spy novel, you know, you tend to need a plot and you need characterization. And it had none of that. But I had so enjoyed the process of just writing it that when I had an opportunity, you know, you fast forward the clock 5 years, I had done a lot of time at McKinsey by then. I was fairly burned out and ready for a change. And I was able to take 7 months and go back to the writing. And the novel, the first novel, really came out of that. And it was the answer to the question, to put a point on it, is I could sit down and write and 6, 7, 8 hours would disappear. And you find something like that, you just want to keep doing more of it. And so that's what opened the door to me writing.
Yeah, that consultancy work at a place like McKinsey, that burns you out. I mean, it is tough work. So
it is, yeah. Tons of travel, and, you know, impossible to kind of have a side hustle writing when you're working 70, 80 hours a week. So I had to take that break, yep, to really get back to the writing and discover it.
And David, yeah, Bruns, I know you had a very successful corporate career that you just up and quit one day and decided to become an author.
Yeah, so my writing story actually goes back. I wanted to be a writer from the time I was 7 years old. And I remember the first book I finished was called The Secret of the Old Mill, the Hardy Boys book. And I finished that, and I said to myself, man, I want to do this for a living. And I was 7. I didn't actually fulfill that promise until I was 47. I wrote through high school. I was an English major at the Naval Academy, which is a bit of a rarity. Went into submarines, which is even rarer because that's the most technical part of the Navy. But as is in my bio, and as you mentioned, when I was 47, I just decided I'd had enough and walked away. Came home and was sort of at loose ends. I traveled a lot, and all of a sudden I was around the house all the time. And my wife says, you got to find something to do. And she says, you know what? You've always said that you're going to write a book. And I had started probably half a dozen novels over the years, and then life took over. I didn't finish them. She says, you've always said you're going to write a book. Why don't you go write a book? I said, you know, I have zero excuses. That's a great idea. So I wrote my first book over the course of about 3 or 4 months. It was a science fiction story. It was not very good. It was a very linear story. But I finished it, and I had an incredible sense of satisfaction. And I said to my wife at that point, I said, you know what? I don't think I'm going to find another job. I think this is my new job. And she says, okay, go do it. So I did it.
All right, so two of you, the Davids, both of you write modern national security thrillers, and JJ, you write thrillers that are wrapped inside of historical events. I'm going to start with you, David McCloskey, for this question. Why this genre of writing, this national security thriller? What is your methodology for creating your story as well? I mean, in other words, how do you decide on the arc of your story, and how do you build out the whole plot, develop characters, that kind of thing? Can you give us some insights on your process and why you chose the national security thriller genre?
Yeah, so the process question will be messy. That'll be like a psychotic sort of corkboard scene in a detective story where none of it makes sense to anybody but the person who's, you know, putting all the little strings and cards up. We can get into that. So the answer to why this genre, I think I have always been fascinated by what's going on in the world and had a desire since I was very young to try to understand really what's happening. And that interest led me to major in international relations as an undergrad. It led me into the CIA. I had been an avid reader of spy fiction, international thrillers in particular, as a kid and in high school and in college. And so I think there was sort of a natural connection between, you know, my interests, my work, and then eventually kind of what I have decided to write about. So that's the answer to why. I also think maybe at a somewhat deeper level, the genre does allow you to explore really the gamut of human experience and emotion in really high stakes, kind of high concept situations where if you get it right and you connect the characters directly to the stakes of the plot, it can be really quite fun because you could, you know, you have a situation where, the world's on the line or whatever. And, you know, the sort of emotional spine of the novel from the character's standpoint is also on the line. So I always enjoy that when I read in the genre. I think my process, you know, I come out of you know, CIA analytical writing, McKinsey, kind of the same thing, highly analytical environments. And when I started writing, I assumed, quite foolishly, that I could produce a story, find a story, create a story in a similar way. And that was incredibly dumb. It has not turned out that way for me at all. And what my process, if you can call it that now, is I try to start with an image in my head of the climactic scene of the novel. And I will typically not know who the characters are at that point, maybe even where the setting is going to be, but I'll have some sense of the spark, the thing that I need to go and find by writing the book. And once I have that, or think I have that, I'll then just start writing. I will do research up front if I'm not as familiar with the, you know, some piece of the tradecraft or the setting. You know, my second novel, Moscow X, like, I didn't do Russia at CIA, and so I had to get smart on that pretty quickly. But I will also really try to limit a lot of the upfront research so that I can just get into the story to understand what I need to research in future passes through it. But it's a chaotic process, because I'll just sit down every day. I'll do this after we're done talking here. I'm going to sit down. I have no idea what I'm going to write. I don't know how the plot is going to function. I don't know all the main characters. I'm just going to find something that I think has energy, and I'm going to try to write that. As a result, my books are somewhere between maybe 115,000 and 130,000 words. I typically write like 400,000 to 500,000 words over the course of the process, because I don't know a better way than just getting into it, writing, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't, meeting different characters along the way, some that have energy and some that don't, and kind of working through it that way. So it's very iterative. It's very inefficient. It's very maddening, but, you know, it's at the end of the day, what seems to work for me to find the story at the end of the day.
Okay. JJ, what's your process?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't listening. You said David. Oh. Well, you actually had two questions, John. One was on why the genre, and the other is the process.
Yep.
And the first question, the genre, is because I think that's what I knew best. I grew up reading adventure stories, and they had a big impact on me. I remember when I was fairly young reading a book that was extremely popular called The Ugly American.
Oh, yeah.
And that had a mammoth impact on me. And I was young, and so I thought, wow, they need me in the Foreign Service. And I think that's what impelled me to take the Foreign Service exam eventually and join the Foreign Service. And I know it's arrogant to say that, but we tend to be arrogant when we're young, right? So that was what got me into that particular genre. It's what I knew. It's what I liked. And if I liked it, I figured there'd be somebody else out there who liked it. The second question you had was how you build out the arc, the plot, and the characters. And when you're writing historical fiction, the arc is kind of determined by the history of the event. So I could not recreate a missile crisis that was dramatically different from the one that happened. And I tried very carefully to sequence events along with the crisis.
Yeah.
But it's more than sequencing, because it starts, President Kennedy makes a deal with Soviet Premier Khrushchev to halt flights of the U-2 spy plane over Cuba if Khrushchev will promise not to give Kennedy any trouble before the midterm elections come up. Then Khrushchev blackmails him and starts sending his nuclear missiles to Cuba. And so then they discover the missiles are there. And then more happens. And then there's danger. And then there's a potential invasion. And then there's three or four real mishaps when war really could have started.
Right.
And so the tension just escalates naturally.
It really does.
As you go through the arc.
Yeah.
But then laying on top of that arc, of course, is the plot of the story. And for my plot, I went back to one of the things the CIA did repeatedly was try to assassinate Castro.
Yeah, that's true.
And so right very early when these things are happening behind the scenes that are going to lead up to the missile crisis, I got these two rogue agents in the CIA who feel that they can bolster their career if they can finally knock off Castro. So they go looking for a guy who's got several qualities that they think they could infiltrate into Cuba with a rifle, and they find that guy in the person of Army Lieutenant Charlie Parnell. And so they go to him, and of course he tells them, "You're crazy. I'm not going to do anything like this." But they got some information on him, and they really got him over a barrel, and they blackmail him. And so he goes along with it against his better judgment, but he feels like he doesn't really have any choice. And then throughout the story, he's constantly trying to figure out a way that he can get out of actually doing this. And so that escalates as well. And as the reader, you don't know until that moment, very late in the novel, when he's finally got Castro in his crosshairs, whether or not he's really going to pull the trigger.
Right.
And so and there's two things that I'm trying to accomplish with this is, one is you're trying to build up the tension mm-hmm. as you go along. So it's just not a sequence of events. Charlie did this, Charlie did that. But each event makes it a little bit more dangerous and a little more, builds up a little more tension. The other thing is, it's critical that the reader care about this character.
Right.
Because if they don't care about the protagonist, they're not going to read very many pages in your book. But it's hard to get somebody to care about somebody who's agreed to become an assassin. So that's why I had to build into it all of Charlie's ambivalences. So anyway, he agrees to take the job, and then the plot builds after that. And then their idea is they're going to infiltrate him into Cuba under the cover of being a reporter for a European newspaper, the Irish Times.
Yeah.
When the Cubans get the visa request from the Irish Times, all of a sudden they get suspicious because they've heard rumors that the CIA has another assassin they're going to send into Havana. And so the plot just sort of develops naturally from the arc.
Yeah, that's true. And David Bruns, why this genre? You started off in science fiction, and then what's the methodology?
Yeah, so speaking of formative novels, a formative novel for me was A Hunt for Red October by Tom Clancy. It came out when I was a freshman, a plebe at the U.S. Naval Academy, and it's not too much of a stretch to say that one of the reasons why I went into submarines was because I had read that book at a pivotal time in my life. So when I was had left my job and I was writing science fiction, you and I met. And I had a secret desire to write a military thriller type book, but I got out of the Navy in mid-90s, and now it's 2013, 2014, and I realized that I didn't have the current knowledge to really pull that off. But you had recently retired, and I'm like, well, this guy's probably got the juice to let me pull this thing off. So we started working together. Co-writing a book is very different than writing a book independently, and we're working on our 10th novel now. So the process has gotten extremely well. I mean, it was very similar to what your other guest described as sort of chaos at the beginning. But after a 10th novel, we sort of have it down to a well-oiled machine. We look at a story arc. We already have a set of characters. We look at a story arc. We try to put the pivotal tentpole moments into that. We go and build a chapter-by-chapter outline. You go off and do the research. Once the research is done, I go off and do a first draft, and then we edit and package it from there.
So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are J.J. Harrigan, David McCloskey, and David Bruns, all of whom are noted authors of national security thrillers. So David Bruns, you also write science fiction. Where did you get your inspiration for writing in that genre? Do you take science fiction we understand today and then project out decades, or do you create things? How different is your science fiction writing from the national security thriller writing?
So in terms of story, story, I don't think it's that different in terms of what science fiction means to me. The other formative novel in my history is Dune by Frank Herbert. Came out in 1965. We're almost 60 years later, and it's still, I think, pretty relevant. So the beauty of science fiction to me, and I was a Star Trek guy and all that, the beauty of science fiction to me is that you can build a secondary world, and you can talk about things, and you can have story elements where you can set the, you can set your own rules. I think the rules of story and the rules of narrative still apply, but you're putting it into a different setting and making that setting an integral part of the story. For me, that was a natural place to start, and then I wanted to branch out into national security thrillers from there.
All right, and are you actually going to go into the crime novel area in the next year?
It is possible the next year we'll see another change of genre yet. When I grow up, I will settle on one genre, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. And J.J. Harrigan, your process for selecting an historical event, what is it about history that compels you to create a fictional story inside a particular crisis? You chose the Cuban Missile Crisis, Robert Kennedy's run for president, and the Iranian hostage crisis for your three current books. Those are pretty heavy topics. Having read Goodbye Cuba, I was deeply impressed, frankly, with the elements of your storytelling. So how do you choose an historical crisis?
Well, very early in the game, I knew that I wanted to write an adventure story, a thriller-type story. And I knew I wanted to set it somewhere in the period from World War II toward the end of the century. And so I remember sitting down with a yellow pad, listening all the crises that I could think of. But I also wanted this story to be one that had an upbeat ending. Because so much of our literature today is so dystopic that it's depressing. And so you say, what could be upbeat about the threat of nuclear war? And what's upbeat is that it does not happen.
Yeah.
And this, in my mind, was from the Berlin airlift in 1949 to the fall of the Soviet Union. This incident was the single most successful American adventure during that entire period, because it didn't lead to a war. It stopped a war, and a lot of things changed as a consequence of that. So I'm sitting there with my legal pad, and so Cuba just jumps out immediately. And that's why I go into that one. And then I'm not sure exactly why I picked Bobby Kennedy for the next one, except that I had to do something on the Vietnam War, because that clearly, I mean, that's the major disaster of our lifetimes. And and I set it around the last 3 months of the spring of 1968, which was a very tumultuous time around the world.
Yes.
And so it allowed me to bring a lot of that stuff in as well. And I had a character because my character in Goodbye Cuba was in his early 20s. All I had to do from 60 to 68 was age him by six more years. And boom, I could plug him into the next story. Then the third one I picked, I'm not sure exactly why I picked the Iranian hostage crisis, except that watching it had such a powerful impact. Having served in an American embassy overseas, it was almost like a personal affront that these people would invade the American embassy,
right,
and hold these diplomats hostage. And so I empathized with those guys all the way through, and finally ended up constructing this story built around the guy who gets taken hostage and his wife back in America who has to deal with it. They both have to deal with it in different ways. So that was why I picked those.
Okay. So David McCloskey, you spent a good number of years as an analyst at CIA. Did that influence your plot development and help you create characters? If you want to differentiate, frankly, between Damascus Station, your first novel, and Moscow X, your second novel, that'd be very interesting for us.
Yeah, there were distinctions between the two from a process standpoint, for sure. You know, the CIA experience, and in particular, I'll start with Damascus Station, which was my first novel, and while none of it is autobiographical, it drew a lot on different experiences that, and really a lot of different events that had happened in Syria over the course of my time working on the country. And so I had, I think, mental images of both CIA officers, you know, who had worked with me, lived in Damascus with me, and Syrian intelligence officers, Syrian palace officials who I had studied very closely. And so I had these little nuggets of reality that, you know, I think it's probably fair to say in many cases the truth really is more strange than any kind of fiction you can put together. And so I started with that as the tapestry, I think, for both what happens in Damascus in the novel, but then also the people that inhabit the novel. And over the course of the process of writing it, I became more and more convinced that one of the things I wanted to do with the book, or frankly, one of the things that was happening with the book as I wrote it, was how do I punch holes or windows, rather, into every side of this conflict? Because I think we have a perspective here that either Syria is so messed up and complicated and distant that it's not worth understanding, or in some circles you can have kind of a cartoonish, there's good guys and bad guys view of that war. And to me, both of those things, they just sort of didn't ring true with my experience. So the characters of the novel, both CIA and Syrian and otherwise, really kind of came out of that desire to show all sides. Not to draw moral equivalency in some respects, because there are some pretty dastardly characters in the novel, but to, you know, I think add some real human complexity to it. In Moscow X, the process was somewhat similar, particularly from the CIA side. So when I start tinkering around with or meeting a character, I find it is helpful to have an image of somebody who might be real to kind of start that process, to pick a different case officer that I knew and say, okay, I'll use this, some of the features of this person as kind of a template to get going. Ideally, over the course of writing, the character becomes very distinct and their own person. And then, you know, you sort of are discovering them as you go, but to start with a few traits, whether it could be, you know, physical description, tics, the way they speak, that's very helpful to me in drawing on that CIA experience. I'll also say, because, you know, my characters in the novel are, you know, CIA officers or Russian intelligence officers or Syrian intelligence officers, spending a lot of time with formers from the CIA in particular, but I had a defector from the Russian FSB who helped me on Moscow X, you know, having conversations with those folks, sometimes in a very unstructured way, just kind of talking about something, you start to get great material for that story or future stories just from hearing them speak. So that's kind of been the process. I think the CIA experience was so helpful because my characters work for the CIA, so I can speak to people who are there, have worked there, and through that, you know, hopefully build kind of a rich view of what that role really looks like and what those people are really like, which I can then infuse in the novel.
Okay. So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are J.J. Harrigan, David McCloskey, and David Bruins, all of whom are noted authors of national security thrillers. So let's take a deeper dive into your respective books, and I'll start with you, David McCloskey. Your current novel, Moscow X, when did that launch, by the way?
October, so okay. It's just been out for a couple months.
Okay. And can you give any sort of insight as to why that specific story? What was the inspiration for the plot of that specific story? And maybe tell us a little bit about your favorite character that you write about in that story. You've got lots of really great, very colorful characters in there. But is there one character that you write about that you really personally connect with and you thoroughly enjoy writing about that character?
Yeah, so I think the plot kind of... you know, the question that guides the plot and the character are going to be intimately linked here. So this is perfect. So once I found the story, and there were a whole bunch of stops and starts and, you know, horrible inefficiencies here, but once I got there, the question guiding the story really became what might it look like if the CIA got very serious about sticking it to Vladimir Putin and the Russians. And I have a character from, so there's a whole sort of cat and mouse game between the CIA and between the Russian intelligence service, the SVR, their foreign intelligence service. There's sort of a dance between the two that guides much of the novel. The CIA officer that is running the component called Moscow X, which is a fictional component of the CIA's Russia House. Her name is Artemis Aphrodite Proctor, and she is the chief of station in Damascus Station, sort of a somewhat minor character. But as I've written her, I think she, more than any other character I've met, has the most energy, and in any scene I write with her, the greatest possibility that I'll start thinking the scene will be one way and then she will move it another way. And she is a very deranged CIA case officer, a very competent CIA case officer at the same time. She speaks her mind. She has a bit of a potty mouth, and she is, not averse to breaking the rules on occasion to get what she wants or to help people around her. She's also very loyal. So for me, she's the most interesting character in the novel, certainly the most colorful, and she's the one I have the most fun writing, and she's actually the star, more or less, of my third book, which will be out next year. I just kind of, she's grown in importance as my writing has continued, because I just have so much fun with her.
That's great. She is a very colorful character, I have to admit. So David Brun, same for you. You recently released Threat Axis, and your next book, Covert Action, will come out in March of 2024. I know Threat Axis is part of a series of books. Could you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of the series?
Sure. So actually, going back to our process question before, for our first four books, we sort of started from a set of characters, and each book we said, okay, this book is going to be about cyber warfare. This book is going to be about bioweapons. When we got a contract for six books with Severn River Publishing, we decided we were going to do an arc plot across the series. So we knew what the story was, the basic story was at least, for the first four books before we ever put down word one. And so they're linked stories, and basically it's a great powers conflict looking at Russia, China, United States, and NATO allies, and sort of in the muddy middle you've got the global south and you've got the Middle East. So we wanted to look at a granular level, we wanted to look at the things which would characterize a great powers conflict: use of technology, use of AI, the international relations component, the economic component, because all of the economies of China, Russia, U.S. are so interlinked. So we write in multiple points of view. So we write in points of view that has someone inside of Russia, has someone inside of China, has someone inside of the CIA. And we try to bring this whole thing together. So and we stage sort of the series along the first four books, looking at an invasion of Taiwan, looking at a war in Ukraine, looking at the rise of a private military contractor army. And then for books five and six, which we turned in book five and we're working on book six now, we actually shift the focus to Central Asia, to Turkmenistan, places like that. So we took a much more structured approach, and we took sort of an overarching story approach to that series of books. So Command and Control is the first one. You should really start there.
Yeah, of the current series of books.
Yes.
So what's your favorite character to write about and why?
Wow. My favorite character to write about is probably going to be Harrison Cole. So Harrison Cole is a minor character in the first few books, and then comes up through the ranks to the point where by the time we get to book five, the book is really Harrison's book. He's the main character in Central Asia. He's a guy who's come up through the ranks. He likes field jobs. He doesn't like desk jobs, but he made a mistake in his past, and he's been relegated to desk jobs mostly, and he gets that cherished field assignment through a series of unfortunate events that turns out to be more than he bargained for.
Fair enough. J.J. Harrigan, we know pretty much about Goodbye Cuba and the plot structure there, and how you were inspired to lay your story in over that real-world historical event. Who's your favorite character to write about in that story? And you continue on at least with one character in your next stories.
Well, before you pin me down to the favorite characters,
okay.
Let me mention that the reader gets to see a lot of characters in this story. And keeping track of them was a major task. But you get to meet U-2 pilots. You get to meet a second in command on the Soviet submarine that's carrying a torpedo that's got a nuclear warhead on the end of it. And this becomes really important as the story goes along. You get to meet the decision makers in the cabinet room in the White House. President Kennedy puts together this committee that they called XCOM. And one of the beautiful things about this was, I never knew this before, but he taped the meetings. Mm. And so you can get access to these tapes, and you can hear these guys talking back and forth, and you can follow them on the transcript, because you can't hear them very well because the quality isn't very good. And you can feel the tension in that room as they're wrestling with these issues. And as the further along they go in the crisis, the more depressed they get, because they really think they're going to fail and that war is going to break out. So you got those characters. And then also in the White House, Charlie, the protagonist Charlie, has an old girlfriend who's got a job as a typist in the White House, which brings her to the eye of the president. And but being in the White House, if nuclear war does break out, his old girlfriend is at ground zero. So there's a lot of characters in that I really think are interesting. But the most interesting one is two. One is Isabel Fernandez. She is the one that Castro's security chief taps to be a spy, to watch this guy who's coming in from Ireland, to find out if he really is a reporter or if he's an assassin. She, of course, wants nothing to do with assassins. Who would want to follow an assassin around? But she's got a 4-year-old daughter, and she's afraid that if she doesn't go along with this, somehow or another, the major is going to take it out on her daughter, and her daughter's going to suffer from this. And I really like her because of this conflict that she's in. And then, to make matters worse, she falls in love with Charlie. And then the two of them get in trouble with the major, and they're running for their lives. And somehow or another, they get out of Cuba because the CIA's exfiltration plans fail once the missile crisis starts. And he can't get out of Cuba without her help. And so she's a great character in my mind.
Yeah.
And her daughter is a great character. But I can't say much about her in that novel because she's only 4 years old. But she ends up playing a big role in the next two novels because she's nine by the time of the Bobby Kennedy book. And her stepdad now, Charlie, is going off on missions for Bobby Kennedy, dealing with the Vietnam War. And she's somewhat put at risk by this. And then in the third book, she becomes the star of the third book.
Okay.
She's 19 years old. She joins the Peace Corps. She meets an American diplomat, marries him. And then right after their marriage, he's taken captive in Iran and held hostage while she's at home wondering what to do about it. And what she does about it is so spectacular. You're going to love it.
All right. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are J.J. Harrigan, David McCloskey, and David Bruns, all of whom are noted authors of national security thrillers. So this next question is going to be for both of our Davids on the show. How much do you look at events that are transpiring around the world today to seek inspiration for your stories? What kind of research do you do to weave the most current technical capabilities for intelligence or other national security aspects into your stories? And do current crises or events or even long-term national security challenges give you ideas you then build into your stories? Whoever wants to go first between the two of you, go ahead.
Go ahead, Dave.
David McCloskey, apparently.
I'll go. I've been nominated.
There you go.
So I think in both books, and then in the upcoming one, is unpublished third one as well, I have drawn a tremendous amount of inspiration from what's going on in the world today, or frankly, from historical events that I feel like I can kind of twist and play with to work on a plot. There's a great quote from a former colleague of mine named Jason Matthews, who wrote the Red Sparrow trilogy, which are wonderful spy novels. And he's unfortunately since passed, but he had a line. He was asked once about, his novels focus on Russia. He was asked about Vladimir Putin. And he said he wakes up every morning thankful for Vladimir Putin, which I don't think many people can say, because he is a source of inspiration for a tremendous amount of spy novel plots. He'll just generate the content for you. You know, you don't even really have to think about it. And I do think there's some truth to that, in that if you look at crazy stuff going on around the world, be it with North Korea, be it with Putin, Assad in Syria, the regime in Tehran, like, you don't have to go far or read that deeply to get interesting ideas that could be the springboard for a great novel. And I really do, it is cliched, but I think it is true that the covert sort of war, intelligence war between us and the Russians, or between Mossad and Tehran, you know, like, there are things, events that have happened in those, you know, arcs of those stories. There are personalities that are truly more interesting and intriguing and strange than anything you could just come up with sitting behind your computer or typewriter. So I always start there and really try to ground the plot as much as possible in something that's real, you know. That's important to me. And I think there's a lot of great material out there. And then, you know, in terms of research, I will generally, my books, I try to deal realistically with the setting as much as I can, and to deal realistically with the CIA. So I try to make sure that I am being as tight as I can on the tradecraft, and also, frankly, on sort of the culture and the ethos of the place, which I think is misrepresented in a tremendous amount of spy fiction, a tremendous amount of really fun spy fiction. But, you know, it's not, you read a lot of this stuff and doesn't really bear any resemblance to the actual CIA or the actual job of a CIA case officer or much less an analyst. So I try to make that as realistic as possible. I spent a lot of time talking with former CIA officers. Once I've worked out kind of a story and plot of getting the tradecraft as dialed in as I can, and then I do a tremendous amount of research over the course of, you know, the arc of drafting the book about the setting. So, you know, I had dozens of conversations with Russians about St. Petersburg, about Moscow. I did a tremendous amount of research on everything from, you know, the Russian security services all the way down to weather in St. Petersburg, and what do people wear, and what are the desirable apartments, and, you know, food. I mean, I feel like I enjoy that process. And so I try to really imbue the novels with as much rich detail as I can.
Okay. And David Bruns.
Yeah. So I would say sort of springing from current events is the basis for the Command and Control series. We really wanted to say, okay, this is where the world is right now. What could it, would it look like in 5 or 10 years from now? So for you take things like the economic linkages between the U.S. and China. If the balloon went up over Taiwan, what would the U.S. do? What are the options? What are the potential things which could happen? And when you start to brainstorm on those things, you come up with some pretty interesting ideas. The same thing goes with weaponry. So what would unmanned technology look like in 5 years or 10 years? We're actually getting a glimpse of it now. It's been accelerated greatly by the war in Ukraine. When we worked on the second book in the series, which is about the battle for Taiwan, the starting point, and you did most of the research on that, the starting point for that was, this is probably how the Chinese would invade Taiwan. This is the time span. The book takes place over 10 days, and it's a 10-day plan. And the reason why they do that is so they can get ahead of public opinion, they can get ahead of the UN, they can get ahead of the U.S. response. So we ground everything in current events and we project from there. That's really the basis for the entire series for us.
And J.J. Harrigan, now, you write in the historical thriller genre, but I have to think as a former soldier or a former Foreign Service officer, someone who's taught political science at Hamline, that you must see events around the world and think, I know how we got to this moment. Let me go back and tell a story about the event that started us down the path. And before we even got on the air, I commented to you that, you know, your third novel is going to be about the Iranian hostage crisis. Well, if we go back to the CIA-supported coup d'etat that knocked off Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, all of U.S. relations with Iran today were impacted by that event from the 50s. So can you talk a little bit about how you do this process? How does it inform your thinking about writing the history?
I've always thought it would be a fascinating course in history if you did what you just did and then went backwards. We couldn't have this today if that happened. We couldn't have computer chips if we didn't have the radio. We couldn't have the radio if we didn't have the radio. And if you just took that political history and went backwards, it would be a fascinating way to teach history. I've never tried it, though. But the one thing today that jumps out of my mind, if I'm going to try to do a novel on today's issues, it would be Ukraine.
Yeah.
Ukraine, for one thing, I think what happens there is unbelievably important. If Ukraine, well, it's already bad, but if it really turns out bad, America loses enormous influence. Western Europe loses enormous influence. And Putin's role is even more solidified than it ever was before. So I think Ukraine is unbelievably important. And I think there's some, you're not going to believe it, but there are some similarities to the Cuban Missile Crisis. You're not going to believe it because this is a long war in Ukraine and the missile crisis was over in 2 weeks. But look at the resolution of the missile crisis. It couldn't have been resolved except that the two principals, Nikita Khrushchev in Russia and JFK in the White House, hadn't been smart enough to let the other guy save a little face.
Yeah.
And for Khrushchev, this was really critical because it was a stunning defeat for him. But he could save face if he could get the Americans to get their missiles out of Turkey.
Sure.
And pledge not to invade Cuba. So Kennedy pledges not to invade Cuba, and he agrees to withdraw the missiles from Turkey, or nuclear missiles from Turkey. And that eases things a little bit for Khrushchev and makes it easier for him to take his missiles out of Cuba. But on the other hand, there's some quats for Kennedy, because if he takes the missiles out of Turkey, the Turks are going to complain. The Europeans are going to wonder if we're really serious about defending Europe. And even more importantly, he's going to face enormous lack of that'll be so bad that it would probably just cripple his presidency for the rest of his presidency. So Kennedy exacts a concession from Khrushchev. Yeah, I'll take the missiles out of Turkey, but you cannot announce this publicly for several months. I forget what the time frame was. By that time, people will be so enjoying the success that we had, and our status will be so good that nobody's going to care that we took these outmoded missiles out of Turkey. So that's a great story there. But as I look at Ukraine, I don't see anybody doing anything to let the other guy save face. In fact, it's so bad, I don't know how you could let anybody else save face. But I think without that, Cuba couldn't have been resolved. But the truth of the matter is, have I got another minute?
Yeah, I can give you 30 seconds.
I guess the truth of the matter is everything that I've done for the last 4 years has really been editing and revising stuff that I've done because creatively I've come to a dead end that really stems from the murder of my youngest son 4 years ago, and it just stops your creative juices.
Yeah.
He was a sergeant first class of the National Guard. He earned a Bronze Star in Afghanistan, and he'd been working as a firefighter paramedic for the city of St. Paul. And then he just got caught up in this wave of senseless violence that's been sweeping the Twin Cities and much of the rest of the country for the last several years. And it just kind of brought me to a stand. I'm just starting to recover from it now. So So I'm not likely to start any new novels on Ukraine or anything else for the time being.
I did not know that about your son. I'm very sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, thank you.
So as our listeners know, I always try to reserve a little bit of time at the end of the show for my guests to kind of give us the last word. And what final thoughts would each of you like to leave with our listeners today? I'll start with you, JJ, and then we'll move to you, David McCloskey, and then finish up with David Bruns. Maybe a couple of minutes. JJ, the floor is yours.
Well, my final thought is read my book.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think you're going to like this story. The people in my critique groups and my beta readers and my ARC readers, they tended to like the story, so I hope everybody else likes it as well.
Yeah, it's a good story. I can attest to that. David McCloskey.
Well, JJ stole my answer. yes, go read my books. I would say on a more serious note, you know, I think the genre that we're talking about here, you know, national security thrillers, whatever you want to call it, I think they are a great. I think it's an important genre. You know, we're writing fiction. It's about entertainment to some degree. The story doesn't work if it's not consumed, and you want someone to go through the pages and for it to be propulsive from a plot or character standpoint and all of that. But I do think that the blending of real world stuff, be it what's going on in Russia or the possibilities of, you know, a war with China and what that might look like, or the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, the blending of that with the very human emotion and experience of the characters, I think is a powerful way to, you know, or frankly, a powerful compliment to reading the newspapers and following in what's going on in the world. Because so often the conversation about Syria, let's say, is highly political, devoid of any focus on humanity and the individual experiences of people who suffered and died and lived and triumphed through the war. And you could add any, this could be Ukraine, this could be anywhere. You know, these kind of books sort of force us to focus on the humanity at the root of, you know, good and bad, the humanity at the root of these crises and these situations. And I think that's a very important, very human and humane thing. And so I think there's real, you know, when these books are well done, there's real depth that is possible there and can give us different perspective on the world and on other people, which I think is hugely important.
Good words. David Bruns.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And I would certainly echo that. I mean, I think the power of story is how we learn. And the power of story certainly is something that draws people in and gets them thinking about a topic. One of the things we do is we write a weekly column on Substack called The Two Navy Guys Debrief. And basically what we do is we take a news article and we relate it to how that appeared in our books. It might be technology, it might be drone technology. Last week was about we hear in the news $40 billion in aid for Ukraine. Well, what does that actually look like? And how does that translate into real stuff that shows up on the front lines? The answer is it goes through Poland.
Yeah.
And when you put all that stuff on the ground, or you're putting tanks on a train, well, guess what? There's going to be covert operations around trying to disrupt that. So there's a whole nother level that you can go into there. And lastly, I'd say certainly read our books. We write them for you.
That's right. J.J. Harrigan, where can people find your historical fiction thrillers? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. Very simple. HarriganBooks.com.
HarriganBooks.com.
My publisher has a website, BronzewoodBooks.com. And, of course, you can find them all on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. There's print editions, Kindle editions, and audio versions.
Okay.
Whatever way you'd like to read it or hear it, we got it for you.
All right. And David McCloskey, where can people find more about your work?
Yeah, I have a website, davidmccloskeybooks.com. Pretty straightforward. You can find me. I'm at McCloskey Books across social platforms. So at your Twitter, Instagram, and God help me, TikTok. And you can find the books pretty much wherever you get your books. Amazon, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, wherever. There's, you know, e-print and audio, so pick your poison.
And David Bruns, where can people find not only your national security thrillers, but also your science fiction work?
Sure. So the website is davidbruns.com. Very simple. You can find us on Substack at Two Navy Guys Debrief. All the books are available in print, audio, ebook, and hope you check them out.
Okay. David McCloskey, J.J. Harrigan, and David Bruns, thanks so much for joining us today. I have one last question for each of you. David McCloskey, to start with you. Who's your favorite author?
Oh, God. It's the hardest question for last. John Le Carre.
John Le Carre. All right. That fits. You're right in that genre. David Bruns, how about you? Who's your favorite author?
Don Winslow.
All right. And J.J. Harrigan.
Len Dayton.
Okay. So a reminder to our listeners, one of the reasons why we're doing this show is that the holiday gift-giving season is coming soon, and national security thriller novels, both historical and current, make great gifts. You may have heard something you found really interesting from these three authors today, and I would encourage you to explore their work and perhaps gift their work to your loved ones who are fans of this genre. And that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.